Turning this evening to the book of Job, chapter 32, and the first two verses of the chapter. Job, chapter 32, verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Jebusite of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself rather than God. And our title this evening is Truth Unfolded to Job. And so in chapter 32 and verse 2, we're introduced to a fourth counselor or comforter, not connected with the first three, and that is Elihu, a much younger man. A young man, clearly a very pious young man, and totally different from the others. And Elihu has in the past, by various commentators, been compared with Christ, and most certainly would seem to be a type of Christ, but a man all the same. There have been those eminent commentators of the past who have considered that Elihu was actually the author of the book of Job. And that is mainly because in parts of the book, here in these final chapters, he lapses into writing about his own speech as though he is the editor or author of the book. But it's pure speculation. Now some, on the other hand, say that Elihu was no different from the friends. This is a point of view you'll find mostly among the theological liberal commentaries, the unbelieving commentaries, but it does crop up in other places. In some of the study Bibles, seems to be a very dismal view of Elihu, which misses the point very largely of the book. Even the MacArthur Study Bible says some very strange things about Elihu, to my mind, uses words like self-important, verbose, utterly unhelpful, giving four blustering speeches. Well, that's powerful condemnation for poor Elihu. It's claimed that he misinterprets Job, which I don't see that he does at all, and that he makes mistakes in his quotations and attributes to Job things that actually the so-called comforters or friends had said. But that's not the case when you look carefully at the quotations. They're all well founded upon things that Job had actually said. I generally thinks that the chapters given to Elihu are a bit of a waste of time, and really only there to form a contrast with the very superior final statements of God himself. But that's not the right way to look at the book of Job. He's regarded as bad as the three friends and contrary to God. But first of all, there are huge differences between Elihu and the other friends. Before we go into the passage, and I'll tell you about them very briefly. To start with, Elihu does not blame Job or judge him for anything that he did in his life. Job is described as a perfect man, a mature, a complete man, not described by God, that is, as a perfect man, not in that he was utterly sinless, but that he lived on the whole a righteous, godly, believing life. Well, Elihu does nothing to contradict that. He's not like the friends who accuses Job of hypocrisy and some terrible sins, extortion and cruelty and things of that type, which he had obviously never committed. And they're just looking for difficulties and for trouble. So there's a great difference. Also, Elihu doesn't teach the theology of the friends. Their theology was very simple. It was cause and effect. Job is suffering, therefore he's under the judgment of God because he's sinned. It's very simplistic. You sin, God judges you and punishes you. You live a righteous life, God is pleased with you. Justification by works. That was their theology. Well, Elihu doesn't utter a word of any of that. He's not, doesn't subscribe to the same theology as the friends in the least. Elihu only chastises Job for the sin, if you like, or the wrongdoing that he's committed after the beginning of his afflictions. He only reproves Job for his doubting of God and his claims to have been unfairly dealt with by God after the beginning of his afflictions. The friends put the pre-affliction life of Job under scrutiny. But Elihu looks only at the post-affliction life of Job, the unworthy statements that he makes. Job never denies his God. He never renounces him. But he does say some very wrong and unwholesome things about God and his fairness. And that's what Elihu deals with. And those great differences seem unnoticed by the critics. And then Elihu goes on to explain in great detail God's use of affliction and chastisement, which the friends say nothing about. They don't understand that. And the interesting thing is that when you analyse the speeches of Elihu, 1, 2, 3, 4, the main points he makes, they are exactly the points in exactly the same order that God himself makes when he speaks in the closing part of the book. So Elihu turns out to be in complete harmony with the voice of God and the very points in the very order that they're made. And that's obviously intentional in the book to show the agreement. No, Elihu is a messenger of God to Job. And so with that in mind, let's go as quickly as we can. I go down to chapter 32 and verse 5. This is about Elihu's credentials. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. Obviously, the absence of truth. They had spoken nonsense that they'd made up. He's angry at their ignorance of the mighty God, their failure to help Job, the absence of any interest on their part in searching for truth. They're very dogmatic. They know it. For all their mistakes and their ignorance, they're not looking for anything. They're very confident, and they have an ultra-dogmatic tone. So the anger of Elihu is kindled. Verse 8 of chapter 32, he indicates that he has authority from God. I read from verse 7. The culture says, days should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. So the culture says that age brings wisdom and authority. But, verse 8, there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth them understanding. It isn't true, says Elihu, necessarily. What counts more than anything is that someone is taught of God. And the younger person who is taught of God may be much wiser than the older person who isn't. Verse 9, great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgments. So that's the part of Elihu laying down his credentials. And then I go down to verse 13. where there's a curious statement, lest you should say, we have found out wisdom. God thrusteth him down, not man. And it really amounts to this. Your wisdom, your human wisdom, thinks that God acts as you would act. Lest you should say, we have found out wisdom. We've figured out how God acts. No, you haven't, Elihu says. You've based your judgments and your opinion about how God acts on how you would act. If somebody was hostile to you, you'd be hostile back. And you think God behaves as people behave. This is different, he says. God thrusteth him down, not man. This is an act of God, and only God can explain why or what he does. That's going to be the thrust of Elihu. That's really the sense of that difficult 13th verse. But as you come down to verse 14, then Elihu prepares his speech. Job has not spoken his words against me, neither will I answer him with the same speeches as you friends. And they were, verse 15, astonished. And they were silenced. This young man is going to say something entirely different. And so Elihu waits, verse 16. He's very polite. Culture says you should give way to the older. He waits for them to say something. And when they fail to, and time has gone by, then he answers from verse 17. Verse 18, he's full of matter. He must speak. Verse 20, I will speak that I may be refreshed. He must let out this clear view he has of what God is doing. Verse 21, let me not, I pray you, accept any man's person, neither let me give flattering titles unto man. Job, great as he is, and wealthy, or had been wealthy, and influential, Elihu isn't going to prepare the ground by acknowledging any greatness on the part of Job or the friends. He's going to get down to the truth straight away. Wherefore, Job, chapter 33, hear my speeches, hearken to my words. And now it brings us to a second heading, if you like, Job's errors. Here are Job's errors in chapter 33. Verse 4, the Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life. In modern language, Elihu could be saying, I speak to Job as a born-again man. Job was a born-again man. He understands now the three friends were unsaved with a completely unwholesome theology and no grasp of salvation. But Elihu is one of the Lord's, and he announces that to Job in that fourth verse. Verse 6, behold, I am according to thy wish. Job had said repeatedly, if only God would speak to me, or send somebody to speak to me. I am according to thy wish in God's stead. I also am formed out of the clay. Not a theophany. It isn't Christ appearing, as some have suggested, but he's God's representative. Verse 7, behold, my terror shall not make thee afraid. He's going to reprove Job, but not in a hostile way, which will crush him, but to bring him to see light and what God is doing. There's going to be a gentleness, even in his severity, and he points that out to Job. And in this 33rd chapter, from verses 8 to 12, he confronts Job with the main problem. Job had said, verse 9, I am clean, without transgression. I am innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. Not true, say the critics of Elihu. Job hadn't said that, but he had. In these speeches, he'd repeatedly said, I have done nothing to deserve this judgment. He hadn't actually claimed to be sinless, but he had claimed to be entirely undeserving of the severity of the afflictions he suffered. And therefore God was unfair to him. And he wished he could come face to face with God and protest the unfair treatment. So what Elihu charges Job with is quite true. I am clean without transgression. Well, Job had lived a godly life. Job had worshipped the Lord, but he was not without sin. And if calamity comes upon him as a believing man like you and me, he should never be saying, I do not deserve any kind of affliction. Now we're taking rather too lofty a view, even of such righteousness as we may have, if we speak like that. But Job, in his anguish, had spoken like that. He hadn't denied the Lord. He hadn't forsaken him. He wasn't going to give him up. But he had called him unfair and even unrighteous. Verse 10, Behold, he findeth occasions against me. He counteth me for his enemy. That's a serious charge against God. God is taking some sort of delight in my suffering, as though I were his enemy. Why? And in all these words, Elihu is going to reprove him. Verse 13, Why dost thou strive against him? For he giveth not account of any of his matters, which means that God is not obliged to justify himself to you. He's going to explain it in terms. And then there's a beautiful passage here where Elihu makes three major points. Chapter 33, verses 13 to 18. And if you read it through, it amounts to this. This is the first point. Sometimes God visits people in dreams. We're thinking of olden times, but he may do this even today. The limited purpose occasionally of a dream is described here. It may be that a person plans to do something which is wrong. And it may be that in a dream, he or she is warned against it in some way. And you wake up frightened. And you say, well, I can't do what I was going to do. I was going to cut somebody out of something and pay them back for something. And I was shocked in a dream, and it stopped me from carrying out my wrong purpose. Now that's all Elihu says about dreams. It's not about revelations or anything. The very limited function of a dream. Step one, sometimes God sends you an alarming dream, and that deflects you from a wrong purpose. But then sometimes he does it differently. Verse 19, he is chastened also with pain upon his bed. And there is described a very debilitating illness, so that he can't eat, and he wastes away. Verse 21, and his soul comes very near, his life comes very near to death. Verse 22, and that frightens him, and he repents of his sin and mends his ways. So number one, by a dream. Number two, by an illness. Then number three, verse 23. And if there be a messenger with him, perhaps a husband, a wife, a friend, a pastor, or someone who confronts the person and says, you shouldn't be doing this. This is terrible. This is wrong. You need to seek repentance and forgiveness and have a sacrifice offered on your behalf so that there'll be an atonement for your sin. Verse 23, if there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand, to show unto man his uprightness or lack of it, then he is gracious unto him, and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom, an atonement, a means of propitiation, and he'll be restored, and his health will return. So it could be the dream, it could be the sickness, it could be the messenger. These are three methods God may use in order to bring about sanctification, change. We can interpret the passage we've just looked at much more deeply in reference to Christ, and that would be a right thing to do. But I'm just looking at it in the context of Elihu's argument. And the idea here is how God uses afflictions. Now you come down to verse 29. Lo, all these things God worketh God oftentimes with man to bring back his soul from the pit, to be enlightened with the light of the living. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me, hold thy peace, and I will speak. Don't you see, Elihu is saying to Job, God uses different methods to sanctify, and among them are afflictions, sickness to the point of death, a messenger to warn you. And so God uses these things not just to punish, but to sanctify, to improve. Haven't you allowed for that, Job? Elihu seems to challenge Job. Have you been carried away by your unbelieving friends into thinking that God only gives affliction when he's punishing? Even you need sanctification, need correction. That's what it's all about. So Elihu's speech is immensely helpful to Job. Now, chapter 34 continues this. We look just down to verses 5 and 6. Time is rushing on. For Job hath said, says Elihu, I am righteous, and God hath taken away my judgment, justice. Should I lie against my right? My wound is incurable without transgression. What a statement Job had effectively made. This is what Elihu charges him with. He said, my wound is incurable. I'm going to die. And I never had a sin that deserves it. It was without transgression, undeserved. What man is like Job, verse 7, who drinketh up scorning like water? Which is a way of saying, you've reproved God so frequently as though it's easy and cheap to do this. You've lost your reverence, Job. So he's confronted by Elihu with the error behind some of his harsher statements. Verse 8, you're in the same company as sinners when you speak like that. How this speaks to us. When we speak or behave unworthily, when we despair because we've run into a problem and our faith fails, and we become perhaps testy or ill-tempered and snappy and impatient, you're walking in company with unbelievers, is the way Elihu puts it. which goeth in company with the workers of iniquity and walketh with wicked men. You're not one of those, Job, but you're behaving as though you are. And you've gone further in charging God with unfairness. Chapter 34, verse 9. For he hath said, it profit a man nothing. This is paraphrase of what Job actually said. It profiteth a man nothing that he should delight himself with God. There's no gain in delighting in God. What's a terrible thing to say. You've made God unfair. And so for the next verses, all the way down to 29, which I won't consider now, Elihu speaks about God's perfect justice. And these are worthy of exposition, but I'm trying to give a general overview. Until you come down to chapter 34 and verse 31. Now this is what Job should have done. This sums it all up. Surely it is meet to be said unto God, I have borne chastisement. I will not offend any more. That which I see not, teach thou me. If I have done iniquity, I will do no more. That's the prayer we should be making. Shouldn't it be like that? Elihu says to Job. Well, then the last heading will bring us down to chapter 35. And it says, God is never unfair. Never. Verse 2. Thinkest thou this to be right, says Elihu to Job, that thou saidst, my righteousness is more than God's? For thou saidst, what advantage will it be unto thee, and what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin? And Elihu is now going to speak some arguments to demonstrate that God is never unfair. And if I have time, very quickly, perhaps I look at verses 5 and 6. Here's one argument. Look unto the heavens and see, and behold the clouds which are higher than thou. If thou sinnest, what dost thou against God? Or if thy transgressions be multiplied, what dost thou do to him? All the human sin in the world doesn't actually injure God. It offends him and his holiness and his righteousness, but it doesn't take anything from God. Let everybody who's ever lived in the history of the world hurl their sin at God. It doesn't dent him, injure him, remove from his Godhead one tiny bit. It doesn't diminish him, erode from him. On the other extreme, verse 7, if thou be righteous, what givest thou him, or what receiveth he of thine hand? All the righteousness of converted believers down the centuries of time, which is well pleasing to God, doesn't actually make him any more God or any greater than he already is. He cannot be any greater, any more immense, any more infinite. He is God. Human sin doesn't take from him, it doesn't add to him. And the reasoning is along these lines. That's why God doesn't react as human beings react. He isn't going to treat you as an enemy, Job. All the terrible things you've said. He isn't going to strike out at you as though you've hurt him and he's got to lash you back. There's nothing you can do that can actually diminish or hurt him or add to him. So he doesn't behave like human beings do. This is all in support of God's mighty invincible fairness and righteousness. It's all in accordance with the judgment of sin, the rewards of grace. There's nothing capricious or spiteful or sudden or unexpected with God. And I thought I'd mention that, but that's the reasoning of that 35th chapter. And finally, to conclude, the outcome of correction, and I just summarise, chapter 36, the outcome of correction. Verse 6, he preserveth not the life of the wicked, but giveth right to the poor. It's to humble. When he's humbled you, then he'll relieve you. Giveth right to the poor, the weak, that is, the humble. The outcome of correction is to humble. Verse 7, it's to show God's faithfulness. He withdraweth not his eyes from the righteous, but with kings are they on the throne. Yea, he doth establish them for ever, and they are exalted. And that verse teaches the second purpose, outcome of correction. When you're restored, you see that God was faithful all along. He was working to a plan. He was doing something far, far better. And verses 8 to 10 really say that the purpose of correction is to open the heart of man to discipline. And in verse 11, he says, if they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity. The efficacy of repentance is taught. And so in verse 16 of chapter 36, Elihu says, if only you would have seen these things, Job, God would have removed you out of your troubles into a broad place. And then down in verse 24, remember that thou magnify his work, which men behold. He aims to teach you that he's vastly superior to men. You must trust him in absolutely everything. Well, our time is out. We've looked at Job's suffering, Elihu's credentials, Job's errors, Elihu's argument that God is never unfair, the outcome of correction. Elihu puts all these things together, and God in due time will reiterate them. The truth to Job's heart from Elihu. That's just an overview of Elihu's message and its content. May God bless it to us.